You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
My next guest is a very special guest. His name is William Browder, or Bill Browder. Some of you should know him. Hopefully many of you do, and most will know him, of course, by the end of this. He is, well, amongst many things, the strongest and leading, if not the seminal advocate for Magnitsky legislation. He's the author of two amazing books, Red Notice and Freezing Order. And I know some of you have read them because you have told me. So I am delighted to have Bill Browder on the show. Welcome, Bill.
Great to be here, Simon.
First and foremost, thanks for your continued advocacy in this space. And I thought perhaps for listeners, that's where we should start. Tell us about, well, yourself and how you've come to lead the charge globally for Magnitsky legislation. In fact, possibly to even explain to people what Magnitsky legislation is. But you have an amazing story to tell.
Sure. Well, I'm really delighted to have this opportunity. Well, first of all, you hear my accent. I'm American, but I'm an unusual American. My grandfather was the head of the American Communist Party in the 1930s and 1940s. And so when I went through my teenage rebellion, I decided to become a capitalist. I went to Stanford Business School, and I graduated in 1989, which was the year the Berlin Wall came down. And I said, if my grandfather was the biggest communist in America and the Berlin Wall has just come down, I'm going to try to become the biggest capitalist in Eastern Europe. And so I eventually ended up in Moscow. I set up an investment fund called the Hermitage Fund, and I succeeded. I became the largest foreign investor in Russia with $4.5 billion invested in the Russian stock market. Now, that was all great, except for that all the companies that I was investing in were all being robbed blind by the oligarchs. And so I started to research how they went about doing the stealing and then sharing the research with the international media, with the Financial Times, New York Times, et cetera, and exposing the stealing. Well, as you can imagine, that didn't make me a whole lot of friends in Russia. And in 2005, I was expelled from the country and declared a threat to national security. 2007, my office in Moscow was raided by the police. They seized all of our corporate documents. So I went and hired a young lawyer. His name was Sergei Magnitsky, to investigate why they took our documents, why they raided our office. And he discovered that the officials who took the documents used those documents in a complex fraud in which they stole $230 million of taxes that we had paid to the Russian government from the Russian government. He exposed the officials involved. He testified against them. And those same officials then arrested him, put him in pretrial detention, tortured him for 358 days, and murdered him in Russian police custody on November 16, 2009. And that was a day that changed my life forever, because I was so shocked and appalled and heartbroken by his murder that I decided to put aside my life as a businessman and devote all of my time, energy, and resources going after the people who killed him to make sure they face justice. And for the last 15 years, that's what I've been doing. And we came up with an interesting outside-the-box way of getting justice. Of course, the Russians themselves, the Russian government, had no intention of giving us justice. And so we said to ourselves, well, why did these people kill Sergei? They killed him for money, for $230 million. And the money that they made from that crime, they don't keep that money in Russia. They keep it in the West, in stable places where they have bank accounts and buy property and send their kids to school. And so I came up with this idea of freezing their assets and banning the visas of the people who did this crime. And that became known as the Magnitsky Act. And in the Magnitsky Act, I took this story to a Democratic senator named Benjamin Cardin and Republican Senator John McCain in 2010. I told them the story and I said, can we freeze their assets and ban the visas? And they said, yes. And then I lobbied all over Capitol Hill. And 2 years later, we got the Senate to pass the Magnitsky Act, 92-4. House of Representatives passed it with 89%. And it became a federal law on December 14, 2012. Now, at this point, Putin went out of his mind. He banned the adoption of Russian orphans by American families. He made it his single largest foreign policy priority to repeal the Magnitsky Act. And then he started going after me and chasing me with death threats and kidnapping threats and arrest warrants and all sorts of other nastiness.
Well, you became his number one most wanted.
Indeed, I was. He really, really upset him. But I didn't relent, and nor did the U.S. Congress. So that my friends, Senator Cardin and Senator McCain, they said, well, if Putin got so mad about this, surely there's a lot of other dictators that should be in the same boat. And so they made it the Global Magnitsky Act, and that passed in 2016. And then I took the Global Magnitsky Act proposal to Canada, and they passed it in 2017, UK in 2018, EU in 2020, Australia in 2021. In the midst of that, we also got Norway, Iceland, Kosovo, Montenegro, Jersey, Guernsey, BVI, Cayman Islands, Isle of Man, Gibraltar, to just name the countries we got. But interestingly, in this whole story, and I think you'll probably see where I'm about to go, the one country that I really had on my list that seemed kind of logical is New Zealand. And you and I met when you were a member of parliament in New Zealand. And I think we both wanted to get New Zealand to have a Magnitsky Act. And as of today, there is no New Zealand Magnitsky Act. And that kind of shocks me. New Zealand is considered by many to be one of the most sort of honest, law-abiding, rule of law, good countries in the world. Why in the world is New Zealand in a place where if you're a kleptocrat or human rights violator, you can travel to New Zealand no problem, even if you're on everybody else's sanctions list? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Oh, it remains completely crazy, Bill. I know when we first met and discussed all of this years and years ago, I thought it would be, in my own terminology, a no-brainer that this would be something that New Zealand MP colleagues, media, and society at large would accept and go, oh, yeah, of course we should do this, not only because it's the right thing to do, and New Zealand holds itself up as big into human rights or protecting human rights, but also that so many other countries, similar countries, had passed it. And yet, as you say, here we are in 2024, and we still don't have a law like this. It upsets me and frustrates me, hence bringing you on, because we want to keep more awareness and for Kiwis to understand. So tease us through or talk us through how Magnitsky works, because most people here will know that there's these UN sanctions which can be applied sometimes, but Magnitsky is very different, and I would argue even more effective.
Well, so here's the thing, is that when we started looking at how we could get justice for Sergei Magnitsky, at that time, the main tool for getting justice was to impose overall sanctions on a country. So, Iran did some really nasty stuff, and so Iran would be sanctioned, and the whole country would be sanctioned. But interestingly, it had just the opposite effect. It goes after all the innocent people and all the top bosses. They're all flying in plane loads of champagne and caviar and totally unaffected by the sanctions. And I said to myself, why don't we turn this whole thing around? Instead of going after the country, which is a much heavier lift and much harder to do and almost impossible in most cases, why don't we just identify the people who do the terrible stuff and freeze their assets? And so everyone else gets left alone other than the bad guys. And that's a much easier thing to do because you're not sanctioning a whole country, you're sanctioning a few individuals. You can even have diplomatic relations with that country. So, the United States and various other places started sanctioning Russia for the killers of Magnitsky. And the United States and other countries still had diplomatic relations with Russia and still talked about arms control and other issues. And so it's not like you have to cut off. It's just like to say, listen, guys, we'll do business with your country, but that guy over there who organized that hit squad, he's in the doghouse. And what makes this thing even more satisfying is that the people who get on the sanctions list they're just absolutely apoplectic. It ruins their life completely. When you get on the sanctions list, no bank will touch you. No credit card company will touch you. You can't buy plane tickets. You can't get visas. You're just basically, dead financially to the world. And it doesn't just have an effect on the people who get sanctioned. It has an effect on all the people doing the same stuff who are afraid that they're going to be next. And so it's like terror. It's terrorism, financial terrorism against the bad guys. And they're all squirming and not sleeping at night and worrying. And if they get on the sanctions list, all they do is spend every day, all day with their lawyers. And by the way, the UN doesn't do any of this stuff. The UN Human Rights Committee has got like Russia and Venezuela, and you know, the Gender Equality Committee has got Saudi Arabia. I mean, the UN is a completely failed organization. And so New Zealand says, well, we want to just do sanctions done by the UN. Well, guess what? New Zealand is not going to do any sanctions because the UN doesn't do sanctions. And in the meantime, all of New Zealand's partners are saying, you know what? We buy into this idea of punishing specifically the bad guys.
Well, the other beauty of your sanction regime is, as you say, it hits them financially. But it also stopped elements of travel, because as you touched on at the start, a lot of these criminals, they want to take their ill-gotten gains from the likes of Russia or wherever, and they want to live in the West. As you say, they want to be able to travel, they want to bring their families, their kids to Western schools and so forth. And so importantly, the sanction regimes which you've laid out and these other countries have taken hits, as you say, financially, but it's also on all the other, what's the right word, benefits. And they squirm. I mean, that's why you titled your first book Red Notice, because literally the Russians put what they know as a red notice. So they tried to stop you traveling and to effectively try to arrest you. I mean, they were so apoplectic at what you'd done. You'd found the Achilles heel.
Yeah. We hit them in the rawest spot that they have, which is their money. Because these guys, and the thing that scares them the most is all the officials in these regimes know that the regime is not going to last forever. And they've feathered their nests somewhere else, and they've got it all set up so that they can, like, you know, hop on their private jet when the whole thing comes tumbling down and fly to London or Switzerland or wherever. And it's all going to be good. And now all of a sudden, you know, London says, no, first of all, your money is frozen. So you get nothing to fly to, and you can't even come here. And if your name is on the list, and you show up in some other country, they're going to say, you know what? Your name is, you're a human rights violator. We don't want you. Your visa is revoked. And so they get stuck, you know, having to face justice in their own country when the regime falls. And these regimes do fall on a regular basis. And so it just creates a total, you know, life of uncertainty and consequence, real consequence, you know, for what these people have done. And that's what makes it such a powerful tool. And I mean, there is really no logic. So, no logic for not doing it. You know, when I go to politicians and I say to them, listen, I want to propose a Magnitsky Act for your country. I say, one of the things I say is who's going to lose any votes from their constituents for telling their constituents that we're not going to allow torturers and murderers to come into our country? That nobody's going to lose any votes. It's ridiculous to not support it. I mean, there's nothing, you know, to the extent that people are worried about immigration and all this kind of stuff. Well, you should definitely be worried about immigration of torturers and murderers from dictatorships. but for some reason, and it's an easy sell, and it's a bipartisan sell. I sell it to labor and conservative, Republican and Democrat. You know, I'm selling it. Everybody buys it except for New Zealand. And I don't get it.
But look, I genuinely don't. It's one of the reasons I used the word frustrated earlier, Bill, because, you know, working alongside you and other good people over the last few years trying to push this through, it's been like moving a rock. And even after Putin invaded Ukraine, New Zealand passed a Russia sanctions law, which in some ways is Magnitsky or parts of Magnitsky targeted specifically at Russia. So to me, that was good. And I remember saying to the then Minister of Foreign Affairs, and I've said it to the current crop, it's like, just cross the word out Russia and put Magnitsky sanctions in, and you've broadened the regime instantly to every if you will, tyrant jurisdiction around the globe. So we're like a quarter of the step there, Bill, and yet they won't do the final one, which is broaden it out. And I just genuinely don't understand it.
Also, the New Zealand law just deals with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It doesn't deal with human rights abuse. It doesn't deal with kleptocracy. And and of course, it doesn't deal with China, Iran, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Myanmar, all sorts of other nasty places. I hope that some people listen to this podcast or this radio show and that they ask questions of their representatives in New Zealand, because this is an easy one. This is a slam dunk. It's a no-brainer. I mean, how is it possible that I could get 35 countries to do this if it wasn't so easy? If it wasn't, it didn't make so much sense. This is like a product that every political system should buy. For some reason, and it's several different governments, and it's not just one government in New Zealand. It's several governments haven't done it, and they should.
Yeah, and I think, look, if I might, that's a really important point. This is now the National Coalition government, so supposedly centre-right. It's not doing anything. The previous government on the left did nothing, and you're right. What was called our Russian Sanctions Act doesn't go far enough. It's A, it's only one country, and B, it doesn't cover the broad range of human rights abuses. But you're also right. Well, of course you're right, because you're the one behind it. But the American example for me is really important. It was bipartisan. You've worked with Republican and Democrats. Republican president, Democratic president. I mean, if you can get anything to work in the United States, why can't you get it to work in New Zealand?
Well, you know, they say that getting a law passed in the United States is like less probable than winning the lottery. But we got it passed 92-4 in the Senate. We have four of the five eyes have it, you know, all English speaking countries have it, except for New Zealand.
So some might say, well, then why does it matter? And you and I have talked about, if you will, squeezing the balloon. That's one of the analogies. Why is it important that New Zealand locks in with this and just rather than says, oh, well, the other countries are sanctioning them, it doesn't really matter? Why is it important?
Well, very simply, because the bad guys can come to New Zealand. They can open accounts in New Zealand. They can buy property in New Zealand. They can send their kids to New Zealand. They can hang out in New Zealand and feel like, whew, at least this is a safe haven. This is like a loophole. This is a place where we can come. It's a pretty nice country, good mountains, good beaches, rule of law. We can be safe here and get away from whatever we're trying to get away from. And everything is going to be good in New Zealand because we're not going to be sanctioned because they don't have a Magnitsky Act.
And look, there's already some indication of that, as you say. If you're a crook, criminal, tyrant, if you can't move your money to the UK or the US, or you mentioned the likes of the Caymans and others now, New Zealand's an easy target. So it remains quite shocking. The other thing you've always been big on is that if we ever do pass legislation like this, we should call it Magnitsky. And when we got somewhat close in the last parliament, we were getting a little bit of traction. It's on record, actually, Bill, an interchange between myself and the then Minister of Foreign Affairs to say, will you do the next step, which is to effectively take a very particular Russia sanction law and turn it into a full Magnitsky Act? They said they would look at it. But there's always been a discussion in New Zealand to call it autonomous sanctions or a whole lot of other names. But you've always been a big proponent that it should or must be called Magnitsky. Do you just want to talk us through why that's important?
Well, so in the United States, you have a law called the Magnitsky Act. In Canada, you have a law called the Magnitsky Act. In the Australia, you have a law called the Magnitsky Act. In UK, EU. And so if you want to harmonize your Magnitsky Act, you should call it a Magnitsky Act. I mean, at this point, it's become a human rights brand. I just learned actually very recently. I was at an event in London here, and one of the most famous prosecutors from all war crimes prosecutors told me an interesting story, which is he said there's only two sort of names that have ever been attached to sort of policies. One is boycott. And I didn't know this, that boycott, boycott is actually named after a guy named Boycott. And Boycott was some type of, I'd have to look it up, but he was some guy, I think he was a British guy working in Ireland, like, I don't know, 400 years ago, trying to collect taxes from the Irish and like squeezing them really badly. And so all the local people decided to like stop paying their taxes to them, and they boycotted him. And now the word boycott. Well, Magnitsky is now the same thing. If somebody does something terrible, you Magnitsky them. And so to like use some term like autonomous sanctions regime is sort of it's kind of a cop out. It's like some bureaucratic cop out when there's now an international human rights word. It's Magnitsky. It's established. Everybody else has it. So what is so exceptional about New Zealand that you would like use some boring bureaucratic word so people wouldn't know how to harmonize this particular law with everybody else? It doesn't make any sense. And so there was a lot of heartburn all along the way. Nobody wanted to name it after Magnitsky because the Russians didn't want it named after Magnitsky. They actually ran a whole, if you read my second book, there was a whole year-long, multi-year campaign of the Russians trying to like discredit Magnitsky and discredit me because it reminds everybody of what Putin did. And every time a Magnitsky act is imposed, you know, there's always a sentence about who Sergei Magnitsky was. But, you know, at the end of the day, we don't need to be, you know, kowtowing to the Russians anymore.
Oh, no, definitely not. I am conscious of your time, but can you just tell us a little bit about Sergei then? Because you're right. Why should New Zealand be any different to other countries? We do seem to have this funny exceptionalism at play here at times for a little country of 5 million people. But a part of it, too, is honoring Sergei. I mean, he was a young Russian lawyer. I know it's quite deeply personal, but can you share just a little bit more about him? I mean, for listeners to understand, this was a real person doing important and real work who was murdered by Putin's regime.
So Sergei Magnitsky was this young, idealistic lawyer. He was 35 years old when I hired him to do this investigation. And he wasn't a human rights lawyer. He was a tax lawyer. And he discovered, he was just like a guy, I mean, he had never raised his voice ever before. And all of a sudden he discovered this massive crime, which was committed not against me, it was against his own government. $230 million of Russian government money was stolen from the Russian government. And he felt shocked by that. And again, he wasn't an activist. He wasn't a lawyer. I mean, he wasn't a human rights lawyer. He was a tax lawyer. And so he decided that he was just unacceptable that they were stealing from his country and he needed to expose it. And he exposed it. And then instead of going after the people who stole the money from the country, they went after him and they put him in pretrial detention. And then they started to torture him to get him to withdraw his testimony. And they wanted to get him to testify saying that he stole the $230 million and did so on my instruction. And they put him in cells with 14 inmates and 8 beds and left the lights on 24 hours a day to impose sleep deprivation. They put him in cells with no window panes in December in Moscow, so he nearly froze to death. They put him in cells with no toilet, just a hole in the floor where the sewage would bubble up. And they figure, here's a guy with who wears a blue suit and a red tie and sits in a fancy American law firm that, you know, within a week he'll buckle and say whatever they want. But it turns out that he had such integrity that the idea of perjuring himself and bearing false witness was more horrible to him than the physical pain they were subjecting him to. And he refused. And the pain got worse, or the torture got worse and worse and worse. And after about 6 months, he started developing terrible pains in his stomach. He went to the doctor and they diagnosed him as having pancreatitis and gallstones. And he had lost like 20 kilos in weight. And they prescribed an operation, which was scheduled for the 1st of August, 2009. A week before the operation, they came to him and said, sign this false confession. Again, he refused. They then moved him in retaliation to a maximum security prison called Butyrka, which is notorious in Russia for being one of the worst prisons in Russia. And most significantly for Sergei, there was no medical wing there. And the torture and the pain got worse and worse. He was in agonizing pain, and they completely denied him medical attention. And after he and his lawyers wrote 20 different requests for medical attention to every different branch of the criminal justice system. And every one of their requests was either ignored or denied in writing. And on the night of November 16, 2009, he went into critical condition. And on that night, the Butyrka authorities didn't want to have responsibility for him anymore. And they put him in an ambulance, sent him across town to a different prison facility that had a medical wing. But instead of putting him in the emergency room, they put him in an isolation cell. They chained him to a bed, and 8 riot guards with rubber batons beat him until he died at the age of 37, leaving a wife and 2 children. And for me, you know, this was just the, and for everybody who's ever heard the story, it's the most black and white, good versus evil, you know, little guy versus Goliath. And he was crushed. And anyone who hears that story, you know, just, you don't want to like let them get away with that. And that's why, you know, Senators Cardin and McCain, Democrat and Republican in the U.S. Senate, started this whole process off. And that's why, you know, the Canadians voted unanimously for a Magnitsky Act. In fact, the Canadians are just, you know, both houses, you know, and they're the most fractious, you know, parliament I've ever seen. Same thing in British Parliament. You can't hear this story and not want to do something about it. And that's Sergei's, you know, the Russians are not going to honor. Sergei should be a hero in Russia for what he did. Of course, the Russians don't see it that way because they're all crooks. But we've now got these legal monuments for Sergei Magnitsky all over the world, and that's his legacy.
And that's why I'm grateful for you sharing his story. It's a human being. It humanizes why this act exists. It's not to be just pieces of, letters rather on a page. It's just the memorials, which again, keep coming back to the theme. It makes a real difference. It makes a real difference. And I mean, final couple of questions for you. The impact still on you? Are you, is there still a red notice on you? Is Putin still keeping an eye on what you do? Does it affect how you travel and act, if I can ask?
Absolutely, for sure, no question. I mean, Putin never forgives, never forgets. I can only travel to about 8 countries in the world, countries that have a rule of law, because other countries would hand me over to Russia. He wants, you know, at the Helsinki summit between Trump and Putin, in front of 300 journalists, Putin asked Donald Trump whether he would hand me over. Donald Trump said, "Yeah, I will." And it was only a couple of days later, when the Senate voted 98-0 not to hand me over, that I'm sitting here with you today. You know, that they're going after me in every possible way. I'm defending multiple lawsuits. There's death threats. There's surveillance. There's all sorts of nastiness. And the reason is because as you said, we found his Achilles heel. This is where Putin's exposed. He's stolen an enormous amount of money over his presidency. He's committed terrible abuses to do that. And he keeps that money hidden away, stashed away in the West. And I've put that money at risk, and he values money more than human life. And so he's got to make an example out of me. Because if he doesn't, then, you know, other people will go after his money.
I think I might add on to that as well. You know this much, much better than I do, of course, but as I've done a little bit of travel in recent years and talked to now former political colleagues and officials from other jurisdictions, Magnitsky goes really wide now. Obviously Russia, but a number of other corrupt regimes are on the list, and it's, as you say, it scares them. You've also been the author, though, of 2 books. Should probably draw that to listeners' attention. They are wonderful books to read. I mean, horrific stories at one level of not only what's happened to Sergei and obviously what's changed your life, but do you want to do a quick plug for your books for listeners?
Sure. So the first book I wrote is called Red Notice. It's as you mentioned, is named after the Interpol Red Notice that they put out for me trying to arrest me. The book is sort of 2 books, really. It's a book about going to Russia, starting a business, starting a investment fund, and the wild west, wild east of starting the fund. And it's pretty fun. The first half of the book is pretty fun. And then we get into the dark half, which is what happens to Sergei Magnitsky. And of course, that's not so fun, but you really feel, I mean, it's extremely, I mean, I get stopped on the street everywhere I go. People, I mean, my book is, I had no idea that my book would ever be so popular, but it's become a sort of iconic book about, you know, justice and life and Wall Street and so on. And so people really like that book. And then I wrote a second book called Freezing Order, which is named after the legal term of us going after the money that belonged, that the bad guys tried to steal and get out of the country. And we went to law enforcement agencies all over the world to issue freezing orders for that money. And it's all about cat and mouse of trying to get the world to help us go after the bad guys and freeze their money and get more Magnitsky Acts passed. And it goes into unbelievable, shocking detail about how the Russian regime goes after their enemies abroad and how they use Western enablers, like people who you'd think of as being your colleagues or friends to, you know, they pay them to like do their bidding in the West. And so it's, I think equally, both books are page turners. I mean, these are not like academic books. These are like detective stories that anyone can read. And it really, if what I've described here sort of sounds moderately interesting, buy one of the books. You can read either or both, and you'll get a sense for, you know, it'll, you know, I was just at an event yesterday, and some woman was telling me that she went on vacation with her husband, started reading the book, and ignored her husband the whole vacation because it was too consuming.
It could be a win-win all around. Look, I know a lot of Kiwis that have already read the books. I was surprised, actually, not because of your good self, but, you know, there's so many books to choose from. But the number of people who have messaged me over time knowing my interest in Magnitsky and have said they've read the book. So I certainly encourage listeners to get hold of it. I'm looking at Freezing Order at the moment, where Stephen Fry says, a stunning plot, real heroism, and a cracking read. And it really is. Bill, it's late where you are, but one last message you might have for listeners. What should listeners here in New Zealand be doing to help this cause, to help remember Sergei, but more importantly, hold human rights abusers to account? What's your advice to them?
I think that they should call up their member of parliament and say, this is an absolute outrage that New Zealand is sitting off in this island by itself and not participating in global justice as it should be.
So there's the encouragement, guys. And for what it's worth, I add my voice to it as well. Get hold of your MPs. If you're not sure how to do that, get hold of me and I'll let you know. Bill, thank you so much. It's really great to chat with you again. I have been in awe from day one of the work that you lead and the energy that you continue to bring. I just hope it pays off here in New Zealand, as it has across the globe. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.